Welcome, everybody, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 173. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me tonight, for now, just the dynamic duo of Jim Jones.
Yo.
And John Lindemann.
Shut the hell up, John.
Would it be? Screw you, James.
So, Greg is, as he warned us last week, Greg is not here. He's watching football tonight. And that's a pretty good excuse when you consider the time that football comes on in the UK. So, for the first segment here, we're going to do a very quick new business and a couple of your listener mail letters, and then we'll take a break. And when we come back in the second part, we actually will have a fourth chair with Chris Kohler from Wired's blog, Game Life. So Chris will be telling us about Umlaut, his charity event for Child's Play in San Francisco, and also we'll have a pretty interesting discussion, I think, about the art of collecting retro games. And Chris has actually kind of written a book about that called Retro Game Hacks, or it's not exactly about that, but it's part of it. He is definitely an expert in that field. So it's going to be pretty cool, I think. So anyway, to start off with on new business, I think John should go first.
Yeah.
John, you got a bargain, I guess, on something.
Well, I did pick up off of Amazon. You know, I play MMOs, so they had World of Warcraft on there for $5. So I bid on it, haven't played it, and it's kind of one of those things where I couldn't find an excuse not to buy it, but I really don't know if I actually want to start playing it, because I play a couple of other MMOs, and it's just one more MMO. And
especially the MMO.
Yeah, it really is the MMO. I mean,
really don't want to add that on top of... Which ones are you playing currently?
I was playing Warhammer Online. I really don't play that much anymore.
You should cancel that.
I play Ion and Lord of the Rings Online. Ion, I'm sort of kind of...
So yeah. John can't be satiated with three MMOs.
I'm trying to cut him. I'm trying to cut him down. That's thing.
Scary,
like World
man.
Of Warcraft, I was just like, am I really going to play this? Probably not. But for $5, whatever. I'll check it out.
I don't know that much about WoW, and that's I'm sort of willfully ignorant, as mm-hmm. Greg might say, mm-hmm. of the whole MMO scene, because I just don't want to get involved in it.
Yeah, I can't blame you.
I guess WoW has been out for like 5 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the $5 version that you got is like the original base game, right?
Yeah, they've expanded it with Burning Crusade and Wrath of the Lich King.
Right.
There's one more coming out.
Oh, I'm sure they'll do them for the next 10 years. But like,
yeah.
I'm just kind of curious, with your base copy 5 years later, like, is there going to be anybody to play with on the kind of the early parts of the game, or has everybody moved on already?
No, there's still going to be people to play with, because I guess the way that the expanded content works is, what it does is it tacks on the maximum level that you can get to. So that really doesn't affect you until you get way, way up there. And right. Also, it just gives you kind of, I guess, new zones to explore, which are probably geared towards higher level characters anyway, so they wouldn't really affect you in that way either. Hmm. Now, the only one that's going to really affect new players is going to be the next one coming out, which I think is Cataclysm. And what that's doing is it's actually revamping some of the original zones.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've talked to people. I mean, it's really funny, because once you kind of mention World of Warcraft, you kind of find out people play it that you wouldn't even realize play it. And there's at least probably four people in my office that play it, but they're all on different servers and stuff, so it's not like they're all like one group or something. But
yuck.
But yeah, I mean, I've talked to them, and they've said that, you know, you won't have any issues with just having the normal version for a long, long time.
Okay, I think we've met our MMO quota this week.
Mm-hmm. In other words, shut up, John.
Yeah, I didn't even want to bring it up, but Johnny forced
me. Yeah, I know. I kind of led you into it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of funny to me that they're selling this MMO for $5, because it's like $15 a month. I mean, at this point, I'm surprised they're not handing out free discs of that like they used to do with AOL, where, you know, people would use them for frisbees because everybody had so many damn AOL CDs back in the 90s. It seems like on that kind of subscription service, it makes more sense to give away the original disc for free.
I would think
get
that
people to
you
sign
could
up
do that,
it.
But instead of giving it away for as a disc, just make it downloadable for free, and maybe a nominal fee for the disc.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. Something like that. It's weird. So, John, anything else this week?
I've also checked out just something kind of completely off the beaten path, but also kind of in line with our upcoming retro chat with Chris Kohler, is I was checking out Atari recently put up their Atari Arcade, which is several old Atari games that are emulated on their website, which I just kind of, actually I think I saw this on Chris's Wired Game Life blog, and I'm actually really impressed by it. It's real old school. James was actually making fun of me because, you know, I'm just so old school, the fact that I even know or care about or enjoy these games. But it's like perfectly emulated versions of Adventure, Asteroids, Battlezone, Crystal Castles, Lunar Lander, and Yar's Revenge. Kind of some of them, Adventure and Yar's Revenge are both Atari 2600 games. All the rest of them are the arcade versions, from what I can tell. And just Yar's Revenge, it's funny that it's always kind of it's an easy way to figure out how long somebody has been playing video games. If you talk about Yar's Revenge and they actually know what you're talking about. And Johnny actually knew what I was talking about when I said Yar's Revenge. It impressed me because you actually mentioned the comic book, which I had completely forgotten about.
Yeah, so I had a Yar's Revenge. Most of these games are a little before my time, not much, by 1 or 2 years primarily, because I didn't start playing video games until probably 87 when I was 5 years old, because that's when NES kind of started coming out, and I had friends who got an NES. So it's weird. When Atari 2600 was sort of relevant, and even in the crash years in between Atari and the NES, I didn't really have any friends who had video games. So like I just didn't play video games, you know, back then. But then after the NES came out and I started to get more interested, I found out that a couple of my friends actually did have Ataris. And so we would drag them out and mess with them. And Yar's Revenge is one that I remember fondly because, for one, the game, and I played some of it today after you mentioned it. I went to that website, which is very cool, the Atari Arcade website. And I mean, all that stuff's free and it loads in like 5 seconds.
Yep.
So I played some Yar's Revenge, and at first I'm like, oh my god, this is so bad. How did I ever like this? But then I stuck with it for another 5-10 minutes, and I actually got kind of into it again.
Yeah.
And I started to see a lot of things that I thought, you know, this is more, there's more to this than you would think at first blush.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually some pretty cool stuff. And I always love the idea that you use this insect guy, and you can go up and eat parts of the wall.
Yeah.
Which, it looks silly when you do it, but it's actually really important to the gameplay, and I always liked that as a kid, that it's kind of like a really crude shooter, but you don't have to shoot at the boss. You can just go up and eat parts of it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of almost a little bit of a twist on Arkanoid, sort of.
Yeah, a little bit.
There's elements of those kind of almost Pong-like block games, but it's different. This thing is, it's with a lot of those games on the 2600, they're, you know, you can kind of classify them pretty easily into like, okay, well, this is a clone of Pong, or this is a clone of Tank, or something like that.
But I think Yar's Revenge is unique.
It is.
Even now, I can't think of anything else I've ever played that's really like it.
No, and they do some clever things with switching up the wall that surrounds the, I guess, what is it called? The quotile? The thing that you're trying to bomb?
Like yeah. But when I was a kid, the main reason that I remember Yar's Revenge even today is that I went over to a friend's house. He had the original packaging that game came in.
Mm-hmm.
And it included this little comic book. It was like a miniature comic book, you know, the kind that you would get in the back of like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles action figure, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or He-Man. He-Man used to have comic books, mini comics. So anyway, yeah, I remember that Yar's Revenge had this comic about this like guy who signed up for the Space Marines or whatever, and they you know, they had him riding this giant insect thing, and they made up this pretty in-depth story that, at least as a kid, I thought was really cool. And all of those elements in the comic mapped into the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps because, I mean, obviously, you look at the Atari 2600 graphics, dude, they're so blocky and crude that you really, back then, you had to use your imagination more.
Yep.
And I was never that good at make-believe and stuff like that. So having a little comic book there with some illustrations and some backstory, that really helped put me in the world that they were trying to create with the game, and it made the game a lot more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, even today, until I played it today, I remembered the comic more than the game, really, because that's kind of the part that stuck into my mind.
Well, that's how it was with all those games. Even with the artwork on the box, I mean, if you think that...
Oh, dude, yeah.
I mean, like, that was the kind of thing where you would, you know, like, I remember games like Vanguard, where they weren't even really good games, but I would literally buy them because, I mean, I was tiny. I was just a little kid. But I would literally buy them because of the artwork on the box, because the range of quality of games on the 2600, realistically, most of them were pretty terrible. Right? So typically you went by, oh, well, you know, hopefully the artwork on the box, hopefully it reflects something that the game is, that hopefully it reflects the game properly.
That's why my sister and I picked up Rampage on NES,
mm-hmm.
the box art. And I still think today, you know, people make fun of box art, and a lot of times it's really bad. But I can tell you that being a member of both Netflix and Gamefly, when I get a game that just comes in this nondescript sleeve with some text on it that's printed out from the computer, it does feel like something is missing there.
Yeah.
These games and these movies, they feel less exciting and less valuable than the ones that I own that actually have the full packaging. And it's not that, it's not because I value the packaging so much. It's not because I'm a collector, really, because I'm not really a collector kind of person at all. It's because I can look at that package and it makes me, it starts my mind cranking about what that media is about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets me excited. And then that really puts me in the mood to experience that movie or that game.
Yeah, it kind of, I mean, I think it's kind of one of the things that is sort of missing now in this, you know, whole trend towards getting rid of packaging entirely. And, you know, everything is online. You can download everything. You know, you can download a book to Kindle. You just get MP3s instead of even buying a CD or anything like that.
Well, I don't mind that because in digital download, I mean, you can still provide, you know, these visual reference points for when you browse through your stuff. Like, look at CoverFlow in iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a reason that people really like that feature, even though it's not really the most efficient way to select what you're going to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of, you can go through there if you're not really sure what you feel like at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You should go to CoverFlow because you go through there and it just, your brain clicks into these different modes. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, because you know, you remember these different album covers and stuff.
But would you say that, like in that particular case, would you say that album covers back in say the 70s and 80s were a lot more interesting than they are now?
Because
I would say so. At
a
least
lot of, yeah, a was, lot of them probably.
They were
yeah.
they were more ridiculous than they are now.
Well, that's the thing. Like
they had to be. I mean, they had to catch your attention.
Yeah, and I think that, well, you know, one of the things I miss with music is where you would have the albums that were just these ridiculous fold-out albums. Now, granted, like, you know, with vinyl, that's one of the things I miss about vinyl is I actually miss the physical album covers. That was really cool. Ridiculously big, but...
Yeah, they're bigger, so there's more art to look at.
There's, like, it used to be when you were buying a game or even buying an album, it was kind of like a whole package, right? Like, you were buying not only the music... which was an event in itself, but you were also kind of buying the packaging. And the packaging in itself was kind of a show that was being put on.
Yeah. So how did they package wax cylinders, John?
Okay, that's a bad joke. So let's move on a little bit from Yar's Revenge. I will talk about a somewhat newer game. It's only 2 years old. Before I do, I will say I've actually been playing a lot of games this week, but they're all stuff I've talked about before. Primarily, I've actually been playing a shocking amount of the Dark Lord game, the Crystal Chronicles game. And it's funny, this morning, actually, I was playing it over breakfast, and I realized that I was grinding in a tower defense game. Only Final Fantasy could bring it to that level. But anyway, yeah, so I rented Mass Effect, and I remember James talking about this several months ago, and you really liked it, didn't you, James?
Yes, I did.
I'm enjoying it a lot, too. And Mass Effect is another one of those games that, like, I kind of put it on my list because people said it was good or, you know, it seemed kind of interesting at the time. I didn't have an Xbox when it came out. So I wanted to catch up on it, but, like, I didn't really know that much about it. I knew it was a BioWare game also, which was kind of a turnoff. I generally don't like American-style or North American-style RPGs, you know, Fallout mm-hmm. and stuff like that. It just never appealed to me that much, and that's really what BioWare is famous for. And this mm-hmm. game is definitely less of an RPG than a lot of their other
it's
stuff.
It's very actiony.
Yeah.
It is, although the action parts are kind of the worst part of the game. It's weird because actually I'd say the majority of the game is kind of running around and talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't sound super exciting, but when you get involved in it, And the thing is, you kind of control the flow of the dialogue by sort of selecting different... You don't actually... you don't choose exactly what your guy's going to say, but you kind of push him in different directions for the kinds of stuff he's going to say.
Right.
So it's not really rote, you know? It's not boring. It's always interesting what comes out of it and then what the people's responses are. And I'm actually really, really, really enjoying the dialogue stuff a lot more than I ever thought I would. And I kind of dread going into the action scenes because I know they're going to be just okay. You know, they're not going to be as much fun as this Star Trek shit of running around and trying to further the plot and investigating what's going on with all these different alien races and stuff. And a lot of the reason that the, you know, exploring this giant Citadel spacecraft and talking to all these different alien races, a lot of what makes that compelling and fun and interesting is that the graphics are pretty amazing. There are a lot of technical problems in Mass Effect, at least on the Xbox version, in that the frame rate slows down and sometimes there's screen tearing and there's some strange little issues, but I don't know. I'm the kind of person who can usually look past that. I usually don't get too tripped up on stuff like that.
It's not super common either. I mean, it happens.
It's not that bad.
It's a huge game, so it's kind of forgivable too.
It's not like The Last Remnant where it's every loading screen.
Right. Like when you're inside the Citadel and you look around and there's like this artificial lake and that place is freaking huge.
It's massive.
I mean, it's one of the biggest environments I've ever seen in a video game and also one of the most beautiful. I mean, it's really pretty incredible to run around there. I was really in awe, and it made me almost immediately feel this kind of compassion and interest for what happens in this place because it's so cool looking. And, you know, there's fantastic art direction. All the different alien races, they all look really interesting. They don't look like cheap Star Trek ripoffs.
Nope.
A lot of them have pretty interesting ways of talking that kind of help a lot when you're going through a lot of dialogue with them. And the characters tend to be very well written, and they have even very, very minor side characters have pretty interesting personalities quite often. So all that stuff is super impressive to me, and it's kept me going all the way through it, even though the action shootery parts are, I'm not that much into them just because they seem kind of janky. But I mean, I'm getting through them. Mass Effect 2 comes out in January. I doubt I'll play it in January. It'd probably be a little later than that. But I'm pretty excited to see where they take this and all the improvements that they make, because I think they got a lot right in Mass Effect, and it could definitely stand to be a smoother experience. And I'm sure that's what they're going for. The sequel really could be pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I know people that absolutely loved Mass Effect and sat there. I mean, I know one guy who got every single achievement you can possibly get in the game.
Which, some of them are...
It took him like... You don't understand. I mean, some of them are ridiculous. And it took him like 400 hours to do that. But he got everything.
Oh, God.
Some of them are like, go find, you know, 1,000 of this. Mm-hmm. And you only find one at a time.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, like the most mundane one, this guy went and did it. The whole thing.
Okay. Well, I do have other games to play, so I won't be going to any kind of length like that. I'll probably just play through a story and send it back and get the next thing. It's just funny that I'm playing through a pretty big, famous, important Xbox game in the fall, but it's not Call of Duty or, you know, it's not Modern Warfare 2 or Assassin's Creed 2 or Halo or anything like that that actually came out this year. It's from 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still all these games that I want to play, and I'm just kind of... I'm putting them off until I catch up on a few things that I've already got, like Mario, which I'm still playing through little by little.
Yeah.
All right, so, James, I don't know what you've got here. It's a surprise.
You got a dead 360, I know that.
Yeah, that's what I got.
Ooh.
I was on Tuesday night preparing to finally finish off The Last Remnant.
Classic James Jones story right here.
Last, very single last bite, and the last fight's long. But it's like the very last one. And I started it Tuesday night to kind of get a feel for what it was like. And it was really awesome. But I had to shut it off because fights in that game can go on for hours. And it was well past my bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
And I go turn it on Wednesday and the fucking thing dies.
when I read this, you have to understand, when I got this email, when he said, yeah, and I was just about to fight the last boss, I laughed so hard. I got this email at work, and I laughed so hard that I had to shut the door in my office. I just had to stop it because this is so perfect. Of course, because you've been playing that game for 2 months, and I know you're just
fucking months. I plan to come on here and give like a short review of the game, which basically I plan to say that it's got a compelling story that I didn't touch on when I first played it because it hadn't taken all its turns yet.
Mm-hmm.
That unlike most RPGs, while your character is kind of the generic RPG hero, your character is one of the least important main characters in the story. It focuses more on the characters around him, which are much more interesting. And in a weird case, as opposed to unveiling more about your character, the story actually unveils more of the character of your antagonist, who is absolutely menacing. He only shows up a handful of times, and every time he shows up, it's dramatic, and you think some shit's about to go down.
But then they string you out, though?
Yeah, and it's basically, the whole story is everyone reacting to whatever he's done. And many times you don't see what he's done. You get there after he's already done it. I just really think that it was one of the best Square stories I've played in a Square game. And I've played a lot of Square games. Just how it managed its story. And it's just massive graphical glitches probably prevented that game from being a classic.
Yeah.
But it also killed my fucking Xbox, so what can I say?
Yeah.
So, I guess, you know, now that your Xbox is broken, you can play some Wii and DS stuff.
Oh, yeah, I can go back to playing the DS, because I haven't kept that system alive on this podcast for almost a year.
Oh, I played a ton of DS games this year. It's just, in the latter half of the year, they got a little more spaced out.
I have two review copies coming, but I know one of them was F1.
But then later you've got Crystal Bearers.
Which will come out and we may get a copy of at some point.
Yeah. And, and the Skycrawlers.
That's right, which comes out in January.
You know, the innocent ace himself is going to be playing innocent aces.
There you go.
That's right.
It's circular, man. It comes back on itself. Yeah, so right now my new business is my 360 is in a box in the mail headed to Texas.
Yep.
That sucks.
It does.
All right, well, we need to wrap up the worst new business in the history of this podcast.
That's not true. There's got to have been worse ones before we got on the show.
Well, maybe. Anyway, we're going to jump directly into some of your listener mail. And, John, do you mind reading this first one from Donald?
Not at all.
You should mind.
I was listening to the last episode's mailbag while playing Pokemon Platinum and was really intrigued by the discussion of the next handheld system. Still, 80% of the time I'm playing DS, it's Pokemon in the slot.
Pokemaniac, son.
I also know that there's bound to be an announcement regarding the next series after Heart Gold and Soul Silver hit in non-Japanese territories in the spring. So what is more likely to happen? One, the next set of main Pokemon RPGs are DSi exclusive, forcing people like me who stuck with the DS Lite to upgrade. Or, two, the next series are launch titles for whatever the new generation of handheld is. Thanks for all the work you do, guys. Your podcasts are at the top of my playlist after just a few weeks.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. Well, I guess, James, you're actually looking forward to Heart Gold and whatever.
Soul Silver. Damn right.
I mean, obviously, those are not really going to be pushing the series forward. No. It's kind of more like backwards. But what do you think would be the next step for Pokemon? I mean, it's been a pretty slow evolution of that series. You know, with the ones on DS, they did add online play.
Yeah.
And, you know, a number of other sort of community social features, which I think it definitely needed.
Right. Well, it's, I don't think the next one is going to be a DSi exclusive. And I say that for a few reasons. But the primary reason is, with the release of Heart Gold and Soul Silver, this will be the first time since the Game Boy games that you can actually, as the titular slogan suggests, quote, catch them all. Mm-hmm. Because up until now...
all together on the same...
Yeah, on the same handle. Because you can use the GBA games to get some that aren't in the DS games. Uh-huh. So with the DSi, you cannot, to quote, catch them all because you don't have a GBA slot.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of funny that it's just now you'll be able to get them, what, 5 years into the DS's life?
Well, also, I mean, I think obviously Nintendo might hope to spur some DSi sales by making the next Pokemon exclusive to that platform, but I don't really think there's a whole lot of technological reason to do so.
No.
Because, you know, you're probably not going to be using the cameras in Pokemon.
Probably
that doesn't
not,
make a whole
no.
much
yeah,
no,
sense. Now, what I could see them doing is maybe having some downloadable Pokemon that you can't get otherwise.
But they could do that now without the DSi.
Yeah, pretty
much. They
could
charge for them, but they I don't know if Nintendo's going to charge for DLC.
No.
That's not really their game.
I mean, you know, the DSi has, you know, more RAM and a faster processor, but that's not really what the Pokemon series
no.
is waiting for either. You know, I mean, they're not really hardware pushers.
No.
So.
Well, see, here's the thing. I don't think the next Pokemon game is going to be on the DS at all. And I say that because we're due, you know, a fairly substantial... I mean, we haven't had two on the same system since the Game Boy, and technically you could argue we haven't had two on the same system ever, because Gold and Silver were designed for the Game Boy Color.
Yeah, they were backwards compatible, though.
They were backwards compatible, but it was a severe loss in experience if you played it on the Game Boy.
So what you're saying is generally there's, like, one major new evolution of Pokemon per handheld system, and then they just release a lot of different versions of that.
Well, that's the Game Boy Advance model, and so far that's the DS model. And what they do is they release a backwards edition.
Yeah.
So one that you can't play on the system, remade using things they picked up from games that have come since then.
Right.
But if they do make a new system, they now have, at the very least, four generations that they might have to remake. So I'm not
sure. I don't think they have to remake them. I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week, but I definitely think whatever the next handheld from Nintendo is, it will be backwards compatible with DS games. I think that's extremely
I think it has
likely.
To be, pretty much.
They have two generations they need to remake then.
But they don't have but they still don't have to remake anything, James. I mean, you just said that now you can collect them all
for the first time in years.
On DS. You can put them all on one game cartridge.
That's true, but you need
And then you can and then, you know, on the next handheld system, if it's compatible with DS, which it will be, then you can just move those into that.
That's
or
sick,
you
though.
Could even use something like Pokemon Box or Pokemon Ranch
oh,
or
God.
Any of that crap. I mean, you could also use a console to sort of wirelessly transfer some stuff, so, you know, even if the DS card won't work in the next handheld, there's still other ways
That's
to do
really,
that.
That's really, really skeevy, though, because you'll have to go GBA game to DS game, DS game to whatever game.
Yeah.
That's some sick shit, man.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Pokemon fans are used to this. There have been... Pokemon is like the original connectivity...
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
And pioneer with N64 and stuff like that, so...
Yeah, that's pushing the sick shit meter to the new level, though. What I think's more likely is that the next evolution of the game, that they'll basically allow themselves to disconnect from the need for all these versions.
It needs a reboot, right?
I think what will happen is they will reboot. It'll be the same basic game, but and there will still be color versions, but I don't think you're going to need six games to catch them all anymore. I think they're more willing to... And that is literally how many it takes, right? You have to own six fucking games.
Well, you could also know other people. And
you could,
trade
yes.
with them.
Yeah,
that was the real idea.
I mean, you would think that at some point they would take kind of the whole Pokemon library online in some shape, form, or fashion. You know what I mean? Kind of like make it independent of each console or each handheld.
But there is.
I'm not
I
even
mean,
talking
is,
MMO. I'm just talking something.
But
like,
there is a certain narrative that these games all follow that you have to kind of earn your access to these things. I mean, they can't just say, "I'm going to set aside all my Pokemon from Soul Silver and come back and get them in whatever the hell the next version's called."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because you'll instantly...
Pokemon Uranium.
Yeah, you'll instantly be too powerful and you'll just... I don't know. It's a difficult situation for them to find themselves in because the series itself is still fairly freaking successful.
Yeah.
Without making any changes, and it's not particularly complicated to produce, but the games are still, you know, they're still polished. And they still do little things differently, but it's kind of like if they wanted to make a new Super Mario Brothers game every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much you can do with that.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like your idea, John, about kind of removing them, putting them on a more timeless platform, like make it into a service. But the problem with that is that Nintendo makes a lot of money selling hardware, so they like to tie these things into hardware because then you have to buy the new hardware to catch the new Pokemon. And not only that, but now they've made it so you have to buy a lot of extra software just to move your old Pokemon. Yeah, just to kind of... But, I mean, yeah, obviously that's lucrative, but I do think, if you think about Nintendo's, their constant message of expanding audiences and reaching the blue ocean, reaching new gamers, at this point, Pokemon is a pretty high barrier of entry. It's very intimidating. I've been playing Pokemon since Blue came out in America, and I'm intimidated by this shit at this point. It's too complicated. There's too much.
Like, there was a time where I'm sure there was a large number of kids who could, as it is, name them all at the very least.
Oh, yeah.
There's 475 now.
That's why I really think they need to just start over. Start at square one. Start off with 100. Or even go with something completely different, you know? Maybe just change the whole structure of it. My biggest problem, what I would really like to see, and I'm not buying any more Pokemon games until I get this, so maybe never, but I'm ready for the RPG part of it to be significantly overhauled.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like it, but it's too slow, it takes way too long to develop, and it's very... let's say, it's very tied
It's
down.
been designed around the Game Boy. It still
Right,
feels like a
right.
Game Boy game to me.
It's still exactly, you're exactly right. It's too old school at this point. It
That
needs to.
that's why it doesn't bother me. I like that whole feeling of it being designed around the Game Boy because that's how I still play it. So for me, that's fine. But I'd imagine for the average consumer who's not me, which would be 99.999% of them.
Well, the thing is, on the one hand, it works because it's for kids, right?
Well, it is, but
But
now I don't know that it really is anymore because now
James is not really a kid. I mean, I think the market
it's nostalgic almost. I
for the
mean,
remakes of Gold and Silver is not really kids. It's people who played Gold and Silver,
yeah,
which
I
came
mean,
out in 2000.
yeah, but who do you think is the target? Who do you think is still the target market, though? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like I don't think that this is kind of the series that Nintendo wants to like age up as its.
I'm not talking about aging up. I mean, the thing is, John, the structure of these Pokemon games is really more aimed at guys like you and me because Pokemon is basically Dragon Quest, you know,
I would
with a
agree
bunch
with
of
that.
monsters. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying is that if they want to keep appealing to kids, people who are 7, 8 years old now, they can't keep up. They can't keep doing the same thing over and over again. They have to actually make something that's a little bit newer and fresher because those kids play this stuff and they can tell this shit's old.
I don't know, man. I don't
You
know.
see,
I don't know. I don't
that's
know
where
if I
the
agree with
media
that.
monster's been their best ally, but the media monster doesn't quite exist like it used to for Pokemon. I mean, they still make the TV show and there's like 800,000 episodes of it, but you know, it's not on prime time anymore. It's not, you know, like the show that kids
Wait,
watch
did it
anymore.
used to be on prime time?
Cartoon Network briefly was showing new episodes on prime time. Yes.
Holy crap.
It was on like four different networks at the same time.
Yeah,
Yeesh.
wow. I also think that the situation of console Pokemon games is really sad right now because, you know, back on N64 and even on GameCube, you could argue that there were some pretty interesting Pokemon games to be played. And then, of course, you know, with Smash Brothers, having Pikachu in there was a huge deal because, you know, Pikachu was a pretty new character when Smash Brothers came out. So that established him as like one of the main Nintendo characters, you know, like Pikachu is important. I mean, Pokemon are a huge part of Smash Brothers. So, you know, I don't know if I want to count that, but even the spin-offs and stuff like that have gotten really few and far between and really kind of bad, even when they do come out now
Yeah,
for the consoles.
like one of the most interesting non-core Pokemon titles I ever played was that N64 Pokemon Snap game.
Oh, yeah, I love Snap.
I actually played that game a few weeks ago. I was digging through my old N64s, and I was like, this game's actually functionally still kind of held up. Because, I mean, it's not just take pictures. You know, there's puzzle elements in there. It's kind of a relaxing kind of game.
Well, I remember when Stadium came out on N64. That was a big deal.
Yeah, I was fucking hyped for that game.
Oh yeah. Even though, I mean, it's more of a tool than a game, but you know, and they've redone that a few times, but not in a very good
Yes,
way.
Coliseum, yeah, and Pokemon XD Gale of Darkness.
Right. So the thing is, like, even at least with Coliseum and XD on GameCube, they did kind of try to make RPGs for them. They weren't all that good, and they were
No.
really
The
not very
Shadow
much at all
Pokemon.
like the handheld games. But I mean, they kind of made an attempt on Wii. They haven't even tried.
Yeah, Pokemon Coliseum on Wii is literally utility.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of the kind of shit that should be on WiiWare for $10. Like,
It was designed to let you fight your Pokemon online, which you could already do.
yeah. Anyway, we should really move on from this. Interesting topic, though. So Steve writes, with talk about a beefed up Wii coming up every now and then, it got me thinking. Do you think Nintendo's next home console will continue the path of using the same processor and/or graphic processor, just of course with speed increases and RAM increases? Or will Nintendo have to move to a newer processor type? Considering that backwards compatibility with GameCube isn't that important at this point, but that maintaining backwards compatibility with the Wii is a much more important trait, how do you feel Nintendo will approach this situation? By the way, RFN is the best video game podcast out there. Look forward to it every week.
I have an answer. They should stick with Hollywood and Broadway because they don't fucking melt.
Well, this is not the week to ask James about processors, I guess. John, you're kind of more of a techie guy, I feel like. I mean, do you have a feel for this?
Well, the thing is, really, Nintendo has always been kind of tech agnostic. They aren't like Sony and Microsoft in the sense that Sony and Microsoft, they always have tech to push, right? They kind of use their games to push their Blu-ray. they use their games to push their Windows, Xbox Live kind of stuff, like gaming platforms, whatever, their networking. Nintendo, they basically look at what do we want to accomplish entertainment-wise and what can we do to give that to people in the cheapest manner possible, not necessarily in the like looking to compromise what they're going to give the customer, but
most efficiently.
Yeah, like basically we don't charge somebody extra money for something that they don't really need.
Yeah, we're not going to make a $600 system so we can sell Blu-ray players.
Exactly. Right. Nintendo has no interest in doing that, and that's why they've made so much money, and that's why they're so successful.
Yeah, look at Sony's commercials where they say it only does everything.
Yeah.
Like you would never say that about any Nintendo system, and I think that will continue to be their MO.
Yeah.
They don't need to do. I mean, Sony is the worst about this. They're worse than Microsoft by leaps and bounds because. On the PS2, they were trying to use it to sell Magic Gate memory sticks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right. The Magic Ridiculous. Gate memory stick is the worst invention Sony's had since the Betamax.
Yeah.
It's like, let's make a portable type of memory that costs six times more than our nearest competitor.
Well, I think UMD trumps all that, but please
yeah,
continue.
Yeah, that doesn't count, though. That's not an invention. That's a travesty. UMD, even Sony was like, holy shit, what was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think Nintendo is very happy to pick up technologies that other consoles have already been using.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, whenever the successor to Wii comes out, it wouldn't shock me that if it has a Blu-ray drive. I mean, at that point, Blu-ray drives will be affordable enough that they can probably stick it in there without creating a hugely expensive system.
Right.
And why not? They get plenty of storage, and they can make it into a movie player that you might actually use.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I understand why the Wii doesn't play DVDs, because like by that time, nobody cares. By 2006,
yeah,
nobody wants a DVD player. But I think in 2010 or 2011, people probably still want a Blu-ray player.
Yeah, it's funny because when that first happened, I think I have a forum post about this. When they first announced it wasn't going to play DVDs, I made a comment like, I was upset, and then I came back a few minutes later. I was like, wait a minute, I just did a count. I have six devices in my house to play DVDs.
Yeah, right, you just don't need to. And I mean,
like right. The initial response was upset, and I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, this summer I bought a computer that doesn't even have a disk drive.
Yeah, me too.
Because
yeah.
I don't even care.
See, the thing is, what Nintendo tends to do is they tend to like let other companies like Sony and you know Microsoft, you know, those companies are like the ones that are kind of out there doing all this kind of risky sort of stuff.
Yeah, they're
right?
willing to take a bath on
it. Yeah, exactly. Completely take a bath on it. Spend billions, right? And Nintendo's just
yes.
like, okay, whatever, that's cool. You know, we'll just sit here and we'll basically serve the customers that we know we can serve. And, you know, they have like all of their franchises that people buy, Mario Kart, all that kind of stuff. People eat that shit up. And Nintendo continues to sell it. And, you know, it's like we can sit here and we can bitch about kind of Nintendo putting the same thing out over and over again. And while I think that they've been doing that, they've been getting worse over time doing that. You can't argue with their success. And you can't argue with them saying, okay, well, the 360 has done really well. We know that we have better games than pretty much anything on the 360, really, when it comes right down to it. I mean, there are certain parts of the market that, you know, like their Gears of War, stuff like that. But I mean, in terms of a mass audience, Nintendo's games trump anything on the 360 easily,
oh, yeah.
right? And why not? I mean, it makes perfect sense for Nintendo to say, okay, well, what if we took the 360, which people have obviously liked since 2005, and why don't we just come in and basically, instead of people buying a 360 right now, we could just put out something equivalent to the 360, which probably is, I mean, I think the 360 is kind of like borderline profitable now, like
yeah,
in terms of consoles, the hardware.
Yeah, it's just on the edge, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and Nintendo could easily just come in and, I mean, anything, I think it's pretty much assumed right now that people really don't need anything more than the graphics capability of the PS3 and 360.
No, not really.
And give that to Nintendo?
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't expect Nintendo to go beyond that.
No.
I'll be pretty happy if they match it. Like, the thing is, you know, Nintendo, I sort of understand with Wii why they didn't want to go HD, because it's expensive to make those games, and
yeah.
it's sinking companies.
Really, really expensive.
But I think part of the problem is that a lot of these companies, they don't really know how to efficiently make those games, because there are companies who are doing it and making plenty of money, even if they're not selling tons of copies of it. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a way to do it. I also think Nintendo is not really a fan of doing these declarations or standardized levels that you have to have. You know, for Xbox, every game has a support at least 720p.
Right.
Every single game has to have some kind of online mode. I mean, it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Like, it served some purpose, and I think in some cases it probably turned out well, but Nintendo's not going to do anything like that. So I think Nintendo, their next system, it will at least output 720p.
Yeah.
But Nintendo will probably lead the way and say, you know what, not every game has to be 720p, and we'll show you by putting out one of our launch titles at 480p.
Just
to show that we can.
I do think they'll say if you do 480i, though, you're a bastard, you don't get to make it.
Yeah, I mean, progressive scans should be...
Even now, any game that comes out in 480i, I vote that Nintendo World Report should knock 2 points right off its score
It's pathetic. There's absolutely no
excuse. So can we go back and actually take 2 points off Mad World right now?
I bet, you know, I don't think Neil would argue with that if you did it. But there's an interesting part of this question that we haven't addressed yet, and that's backwards compatibility. So let's take it one part at a time. There's two parts of this. First, do you think the next system will have GameCube backwards compatibility?
Yes. Because I believe it'll be Wii backwards compatible,
yeah.
Which means by default it's effectively already GameCube backwards compatible as long as you put the little controller software in there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you have to have controller ports, but that's not a big deal.
You know what? They could very easily get around that though this time. They could say, it's not.
Yeah, 100%. They could make like a wireless box that you put on your table, and it communicates with the system, and then you just plug your controllers into that box.
Don't you think that they could emulate the GameCube controller and software?
Yes, exactly.
And seriously, like switch it, like switch your controller into GameCube mode.
See, right now they can't because the system actually thinks it's a GameCube.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of feel like the next system probably will not be backwards compatible with Wii.
Really?
For the main reason that I think they'll probably go a somewhat different direction with the controller. I'm not saying they're gonna leave behind motion control, but I think they'll take a different approach to it that may not be compatible really. And also, I think with the Wii especially, they're going to feel like it's not that important. Because if you think about who backwards compatibility is important to, it tends to be the really high-level user who has a collection of games that he really cares about, that he wants to be able to play on all the new hardware going forward so he doesn't have to mess with multiple systems.
Yeah.
And I think most of the software with Wii is either so disposable that people won't really care that they won't be able to play it on the new system, or it's so tied in with the identity of Wii that they wouldn't think of playing it on any other system.
Hmm. You mean like Wii Sports?
Yeah. Like, I don't expect to be playing Wii Sports on the next system.
Because it's going to come with Wii Sports 3. And then you're done for.
I mean, maybe it will under a different name. Maybe it will. But if it does, I certainly won't want to play. I mean, now that I have Resort, I really don't want to go back and play the first Wii Sports, even though they're separate. Mm-hmm. So,
but see, all their past history indicates that they will do it.
Well, not all. N64 wasn't backwards compatible
with anything.
Fine. Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Nintendo could have easily been backwards compatible with the NES, and it wasn't.
The thing is, too, I could see Nintendo kind of going the route of retrofitting or remaking games rather than... trying to cater to backwards compatibility. I mean, I think there's a reason why, you know, I mean, Sony got a lot of heat for dropping it out of the PS3, but it doesn't really stop people from buying 440,000 of them or whatever, you know?
Right. I think the reason people got really angry about it on PS3 is, number one, Sony promised it in the beginning.
Right. They had it
very,
in the beginning,
very
yeah.
adamantly. They said, like, we will always have backwards compatibility. And then they took it out for cost reasons. I don't blame them for taking it out, but it was kind of the way they set it up. Like,
it
this
was
is
kind
one
of
our core principles, and then they just turned around on it.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing is, that system was $600. I mean, for $600, it better mow my lawn. You're damn straight it should play my PS2 games.
Yep.
You know, at $300, I don't care.
Well, yeah. And I think part of that also comes down to the PS2 it was the 360 of this generation. It dies. And a lot of people like to say, well, this system will play all my old games. I don't need to worry about my old system anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Its survivability is no longer an issue. You can go throw it out in the street for all I care. So I like to be able to get rid of systems. Although I don't really get rid of them. I just put them aside.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I still have to keep my N64 in working condition because I can't play all my games without it.
Because they won't put any of them on Virtual Console.
Exactly.
Well, I do think the shining light here, the silver lining, is that I do think the next system, even if it's not backwards compatible with GameCube or Wii, I do think it will continue Virtual Console. And because Nintendo knows that people have built up this library of stuff, I mean, that's why they put out the storage solution. They know this group exists that downloads a lot of games.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Virtual Console will continue to be compatible with the next system and your library will carry over. And they've already got the infrastructure in place to do that. You know, the Wii Shop knows what games you've bought, you can re-download them.
Right.
So it all they have to do is flip a switch to let you download it on a second system. That's pretty easy to do. So all they have to do is transfer the licenses. So I do think that will happen. As far as whether you'll be playing your Wii games on the next system, like I said, my guess is no, but I don't think most people really care that mm-hmm. much. I mean, for one thing, the Wii is a tiny system. It's not a big deal to keep it around. It's not like it's not like the original Xbox where it takes up your entire shelf.
Yeah, so. That thing was like the old school VCRs.
Oh yeah. All right. Well, we better move on. And James has the last question here.
Right. This is from.
Well, we don't know.
This is from unknown.
Yep.
It's good to know. This question is not about Nintendo, but gaming in general. I'm a 22-year-old college student, and I'm finding my interest in gaming as decreasing as the years go by. I like to think of myself as a, quote, hardcore gamer. I mean, I've beaten MGS2 five times, and I was one of the very few people who did not have a battery in the original Zelda game, so I couldn't save my progress. As an adult gamer, I'm finding it hard to let myself be immersed in deep, long games. I have no problem with New Super Mario Bros. Wii, but I do have a problem with the Zeldas and Metroids in the gaming universe. None of my friends are gamers. So, you guys are my last resort.
That's a sad thought.
Have you ever forced yourself to play a game? Have you ever had a period of time where you did just not want to play a game? Have you ever found a great game boring? Do you feel weird playing a game like Modern Warfare 2 with little kids, even though they shouldn't be playing it? Because I feel this way, I tend to play more retro games like Battletoads, Mario, Castlevania, but I simply can't play Fallout 3 or Mass Effect, no matter how great it is. Please discuss this. I don't think I'm the only one who feels this way.
Okay, so the really funny thing is the title of his email is Older Gamers, and he starts out by saying he's 22.
Yeah, I know.
And all three of us, and Greg too, we're all older than 22, so that's just funny to me. You're not that old, so don't start feeling old at age 22. Please don't.
Yeah, first off, I think we have to rephrase part of his question for us, which is the have you ever forced yourself to play a game bit, because yes,
oh
we
yeah
all
absolutely
have.
Reviewing games for sure,
right?
Yeah, that
right,
doesn't
right.
apply to us,
right? I'm
have
used
you forced
to it.
Yourself to play
I've turned a off the part of my brain that gets pissed off playing a game that I don't really want to play. It's just
yeah,
I've broken down my tolerance for that.
I rev that part of my brain up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to rephrase it to have we ever forced ourselves to play a good game.
Yeah, that's an interesting question when you phrase it like that.
I can say definitely I have.
Yeah, I have.
I can say that for some reason, and I'm sure many Nintendo fans will turn off the podcast for this, but the one game that, and you probably know what I'm going to say, Super Mario Galaxy, you know it, because I just could not, for some reason, it just did not grab me. And I know that, you know, at some point I plan to come back to it.
2014.
Well, John, I think a lot of us are going to be coming back to it next year in the sequel.
Except we'll have paid $50 for it.
Yep.
Now, I mean, it's interesting to me because I'm a big movie buff, and you know, movies have been around for much longer than games.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got to be a teenager, I started to get really interested in movies and classic movies and important movies that kind of changed the world or changed the movie business or changed the way people thought about movies. I started going back and kind of trying to watch movies like, I mean, last year I watched Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not really a movie that I had a lot of interest in the subject matter.
Yeah.
And it's like 3.5 hours
it's
long.
It's a long
ass. So it's a really good movie, though.
It's better than I expected. Yeah,
yeah.
It's not one of my favorites. But, I mean, I watched it because...
John watched it every weekend.
It is culturally significant, and I wanted to be in on the conversation regarding that movie. And I wanted to see how it influenced other movies that I really like that came after it. So, I mean, with a movie, I do this all the time. All the time, I rent movies based on, you know, I don't really expect that I'm going to like them, but I want to give them a chance because they're famous or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm kind of studying them for almost academic reasons, even though, you know, I'm obviously not a film student. So, not officially. So, I just don't really think of myself doing that with games as much. And partly it's because games require so much more effort to go through, usually more time and always more effort than watching a movie.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not something that I do very often, but also very few games would I go into feeling like I know this is like highly regarded. I know I'm going to hate it, but I'm going to play it anyway. It would take something like the new Gran Turismo or something. Like, that would be a game that I would go into it, but it's $60. Why would I go spend $60? I wouldn't even rent it because I know I'm not going to like it.
Mm-hmm.
So with games, I don't think I do that. It's interesting that I do. I'm very happy to do that with movies, and I do it all the time, and I don't really think I ever do that with games.
Well, see, maybe the it isn't that you're going to hate the game. It's just that you know you'll enjoy it, but you just don't feel like putting in the investment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, you're right. And
that
would
probably be more accurate with me and Mario Galaxy.
Because I think we actually have done this a few times in Retroactive. And it depends on what your expectation is. You know, like some of these games I knew very little about. Like Dynamite Heady, I wasn't dreading it. I just had no expectation whatsoever going into it. With something like Super Ghouls and Ghosts, that was the first time in a long time that I can remember playing a game that I already knew I did not like and trying to make myself keep playing it. I haven't done that since I reviewed, and I haven't reviewed anything in a year. So that was a weird feeling over the summer to be playing through Super Ghouls and Ghosts thinking, man, I really, really fucking hate this, but I'm going to try to at least finish. I'm gonna try to finish the first level so I can talk about it. Because I feel like I owe it to myself and to the listeners and to the other guys on the podcast to at least give this a couple of hours, you know, to give it an honest chance.
Yeah, give it a college try.
And I did. I made myself do it, and I beat the first level, and I actually tried playing the second level, and that's where I quit. But that was a weird feeling, and in Retroactive, I mean, I don't want to say I'm a better man because I had to go through that, but for me with games, it's more about I'm a lot more willing to take a chance on a game that I'm still open-minded about.
Yeah, I think I've forced myself to play games that I acquired because I wanted to play them.
Because you already spent money on them?
Well, and that, and because I did want to play them, but I didn't want to make the time investment, if that makes sense. Like, I knew this game's going to take 200 hours. And I'm interested in playing it.
I just try not to buy games that involve the word 200 hours.
It's a game that I want to play. It's just a game that I never feel like I have enough time to sit down and play it.
Yeah.
So I force myself to make time to sit down and play it. But the whole time I'm consciously aware of the fact that I've sort of adjusted things so I can play this game.
But you're still enjoying it as you play.
Yeah, I am. I'm enjoying it. It's just I'm having to go, all right, let's...
Right.
What can I not do in order to have time to play?
It's not really a slog. You know, it's not like you're forcing yourself through it. I mean, with a book, sometimes with a book, I force myself to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, I read Swan's Way. It took me 3.5 years, but I finally finished Swan's Way this year, which is the first part of Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. And that is not a pleasure read. I mean, it is not a book that you read for entertainment. There is no plot. It's like 300, just the part I read, which is 1/7 of the entire thing. It's longer than the Bible. And the part I read is like 300 pages of descriptions. And the sentences sometimes go on for 2-3 pages without stopping. I mean, it is brutal, fucking brutal. And after a while, it just got to be that the main reason I finished it is because I'd already gotten so far into it, I just felt like I had to.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it was just educational. It's just like I felt like I'm going to get something out of this. So even if I don't enjoy it, it'll be good for me. And I think part of the problem with games is that a lot of times, games aren't that educational.
Yeah.
And I feel like they should be, you know, maybe more than they are. And I'm not saying to make Donkey Kong Jr. Math for Wii or, God forbid, Xbox, but I think that games have the capacity to teach us things that can be very compelling. I mean, learning is, you know, the desire to learn is, for some people, very, very strong. I mean, and it can make you do things that you don't really want to do.
Well, I mean, this is going to sound kind of funny, but even with World of Warcraft, I mean, part of the reason why I bought that game is just because I had heard so much about it, and I had played other MMOs where people are like, World of Warcraft is crap. World of Warcraft is amazing. So really, I bought that game more than anything just to have an informed opinion about it, not even to really play it, per se, not get involved with it.
Yes.
And that's honestly why I play a lot of games.
I mean, I think another example maybe with fitness games, mm-hmm. like EA Sports Active. You know, I wasn't exactly reviewing it. I bought that game and paid for it, and you know, I wanted to get in shape before E3, so I did the whole blog thing for a couple of weeks. And you know, I wasn't exactly in love with the software, and I don't really like exercising that much, especially not exercising for exercising's sake.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because I wanted to get in shape. So I made myself play it, even though I wasn't really enjoying it. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, fitness games maybe have sort of brought in that element of it. I think mentally there's more room to be done for it. I mean, there's some productivity stuff. You know, you got like My French Coach and stuff like that. They're not really great games, but they do what they're supposed to very well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It's an interesting question.
I would say a second example of a great game that I had to force myself to play through was BioShock.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Me too.
Absolutely, totally. Because I just found the actual core gameplay to be so repetitive. You're basically sitting there killing the same five or six enemies over and over and over again.
Right. Like, I kind of cared about the story.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the graphics. And I mean, there are things about BioShock that I appreciated a lot, and I kind of wanted to see more of it, but like, moment to moment playing that game was pretty unpleasant for me, actually.
Yeah.
Not just the repetition, but like the really oppressive, dark environments and like the really cynical, you know, I don't like games where you're kind of fighting zombies and stuff. Like Half-Life, a lot of times you go through sections where you're just shooting dudes with the crab things on their faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not fun to me. Like, I don't like the feeling of everything dark and foreboding and, you know, we're trying to scare you and we're trying to make you feel hopelessness and all this stuff. Like, that's very unpleasant to me, and I usually won't go through it for very long.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it with, like, a sequence like that, but there better be a light at the end of the tunnel,
mm-hmm.
or I'll give up on that game very quickly.
See, I didn't play BioShock, but I've played games that have that same similar feel to them where there's kind of a story I'm interested in, but the whole game is the same fucking thing over and over again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I either expect the story to get way better to make this worth it, or I feel like the game's just totally screwed you. And I can say that that's never happened. It's never gotten way better. It has never made up.
But
for
James, unlike John and I, will actually play through to the end just to check and make sure that it never.
It could have happened, damn it. and this is why the loss of The Last Remnant is killing me.
Yeah, I'm a lot more willing to quit. When I don't like something, of course, this contradicts with my story about reading Proust.
About
but
the book,
especially
yeah.
with a video game. But because with a game, a lot of times, it's like I said before, with playing a game, I usually don't feel like I'm really gaining anything by continuing to do it.
Yeah, it's purely enjoyment.
You know, I might play it up to a certain point to feel like I'm recouping the money that I spent on it. But usually I'll just be like, sorry, my time's too valuable. I've got other things that I'm way more eager to play right now. So I'd rather go play those. Okay, I guess that's the end of that discussion. Fascinating question there. And yeah, thank you all three of you who wrote in and we read your letters today. You can send your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. It's time for us to take a break, and when we come back, Chris Kohler will be here to talk about Umlaut, Child's Play, his books, and retro game collecting. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
As Christmas edges ever closer, Nintendo World Report delivers all the news, reviews, and blogs that you've come to expect, nay, that you've come to demand.
We have a ton of reviews this week, including BitTrip Void and Resident Evil Darkside Chronicles for Wii, as well as Modern Warfare Mobilized and Band Hero for DS.
Neil serves up a double dose of blogs, continuing his 6 weeks of active series, plus impressions of the PC version of the upcoming WiiWare title Super Meat Boy. That's all for this time. As always, don't forget to check out our other podcasts, the NWR Newscast and Michael Cole's Radio Trivia.
Welcome back to RFN, and for this last segment of the show, I'm going to hand the reins over to John Lindemann, so hold your breath.
That's right, I'm taking over, Johnny.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we're just going to wing it from here, no plans whatsoever, but seriously, folks, one thing I came across a couple of weeks ago was an event called Umlaud, which is going to have the involvement of Chris Kohler, who I would like to welcome to the show, our esteemed guest.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's excellent to have you here. This is, I was actually looking back through his appearances, and this is, I determined that Chris actually likes to appear on the show annually, sort of. This is actually his fourth appearance. You may know him from movies such as Wired.com's Game Life blog, as well as he's written a couple of books. He's a gaming celebrity, poet, all in all, a great man.
I wrote a sonnet once about the Game Boy Micro. That was my only dabble in poetry,
share.
Though.
Please share.
Oh, man, I don't know where it is. I actually did write one, though.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, the last time you were on, I dug through the archives here. The last time you were on was March of 2008 for the N64 Retrospective, one of our more popular shows, I believe.
Oh. Well, I know why it was popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because we weren't on it, mostly.
This guy. Oh, yeah, true.
So what's going on, man?
What's going on? Well, I mean, in addition to the fact that it's the holiday season, which means that it's, you know, November, and it's the absolute busiest month for video game journalists, as we all well know, I stupidly made the decision to start up a charity event with proceeds to benefit Child's Play Charity, which is what you were mentioning before. It's called Umlaut.
Exactly.
Which is, it's like an umlaut, but loud. That's mm-hmm. the joke. So in a nutshell, what we're doing, this is coming up very, very soon. This is December 9th in San Francisco. So if you're in the Bay Area or thereabouts or feel like flying to San Francisco on Wednesday, December 9th, it's going to be at a great downtown venue called the DNA Lounge, which I've been to a few times and seen shows at. It's got this amazing stage. And just the idea is we got it for this one night. We're going to get up and we're going to play Rock Band. Like serious rock stars at this great music venue. Harmonix is coming in. They're going to bring the Rock Band, and they're going to bring 1,000 songs on the hard drive. And so every single song that's in Rock Band 2 is going to be playable.
Wait, now what if someone wants to play a Beatles song?
Well, so here's the thing. We thought about having Beatles on the main stage, but we realized that taking the disc out, putting a Beatles disc in, and then making sure everything was synced up, especially because we're going to have the video running on a projector screen and stuff like that, was going to be more trouble than it was worth.
Yeah.
And so the main stage is going to be just Rock Band 2. We're going to have a free play area upstairs, and it's, you know, during some part of the night, that's going to be Beatles Rock Band. Up there, since we're only just sort of showing it on one standard television monitor, we figure we can swap the discs out. And that's not going to be as big of a deal, especially because it's free play. Now, downstairs, it's actually pay to play. We've actually got 15 already. It's already been sold out. It's called the Ultimate Band Package. And what we're going to give people is, instead of just having the lights kind of turned on the stage, we're going to actually do, like, real rock show lighting for them when they're playing. Everybody's going to get, like, you know, fake backstage pass lanyards. We're going to have a swag bag with fun stuff for, you know, essentially just the real kind of rock star experience, right? And so that's what we're doing for the Ultimate Bands. But then we're also going to have standard bands in which sort of the lights are going to be turned on. It's not going to look as exciting. And also Ultimate Bands got to pick one song, and they're going to be the only bands that are going to play that song all night. Standard bands, you got to get in early and do that. So that's $40 actually to be, do the standard band package. Geez, what else? We're gonna have a raffle with all kinds of my kitchen is just full of swag right now, all kinds of just the random junk that you get in the mail every time a video game comes in.
Like calendars with your name on it.
Like all kinds of crazy stuff. And like that Mario, I don't know if one of you guys got the Mario and Luigi, you know, backpack that was full of Mario stuffed animals that came with Mario and Luigi, the review copy of the
great
new DS game.
Pale probably held that out from us. He gets all that stuff.
So that one's going straight into the raffle. We're going to be giving away free prizes as well, you know, to the first people in the door. Probably a silent auction. We've got one of those Uncharted 2 Fortune Hunters editions that sell for like $3,000 on eBay. So we're going to be silent auctioning that off, and we'll see how much money we can get for that the night of. See how much money people can take out of the ATM at DNA Lounge.
Make sure you get them drunk first.
Yeah, seriously. That's the that's basically the plan, is just to get people as drunk as possible. And you know, so it's a full bar. There's a Mexican restaurant in there. You know, it's like it's a pretty great venue. I'm very excited.
That's awesome.
Tons and tons to do in the week in the next week though.
So, are the bands going to be competing? Like, is there going to be a prize for like the best costume or something like that, or
That's something that we consider doing next year, is actually having judges watch every single band that competes and doing a costume contest or a best band or Miss Congeniality or what have you.
Oh, lovely.
And, well, we're not doing that this year. It's not a competition. It's come down and play, and the playing Rock Band in such a great venue is going to be its own reward.
So this is the second year, right?
Yeah, so last year, this event, it came from Funderazer, fundraiser with umlauts on it, and Joel Johnson, who used to be an editor at Wired.com and was at Gawker and was at Boing Boing, was all over the place, and he had done this for about 4 years running in New York City, and he had started franchising it out. So if you heard of Kotaku's event that they had out in Denver earlier this month.
I've been there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 2 years ago, I was out of town last year when it happened, but 2 years ago, I went down to Denver, and it was at this place called the Walnut or the Walnut Cafe or something. I'd never been there. It was really cool, and Brian Crescente was there rocking it out.
Nice.
And it was a similar event, although it sounds like it was on a much smaller scale than what you're planning, Chris.
Well, that's the thing. The Funderazer events were very much on a small scale. It was get together at a bar. You know, just bring in a couple of hundred people night of, just get them into the bar, get them playing Rock Band, get them, buying raffle tickets for mm-hmm. some swag. The idea this year, well, first of all, it's not Funderazer. Last year we did the San Francisco version of Funderazer. And this year they're not doing Funderazer. That's why Kotaku's event wasn't called it. It was just called Kotaku's charity event. And we decided that we were going big. I mean, we've been planning this all year to just make it a lot bigger, to approach video game companies for sponsorships and to, you know, get raise a lot more money. I mean, last year we raised less than $2,500. We know we can do much, much, much better this year for Child's Play, you know, if we put in more effort. So that's the idea. And we really wanted to have a name. You know, we really actually needed to have, we couldn't just call it the charity event for Child's Play. And so this is the first umlaut, but we did do something very similar last year. But this year is going to, it's going to absolutely blow last year away. It's not even going to be a comparison.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it. So what's your exact role in it? I mean, is it more of a general role? Like, I saw that you it looks like you prepared a lot of the website. What exactly are you doing?
So there's three of us who all came together. At first it was me working with some guys from Gizmodo who are not participating this year. And so at the beginning of the year it was me. And who approached me was John Segerson, Seg, from Telltale Games. He's a programmer. If you're ever loading up a Telltale Wii game and it loads, thanks Seg, basically. So he approached me and said, look, I know event planning, and you can do much better, you know, if you let me join you in your quests. And I'm like, It honestly, personally for me, it took me a while to come around and say, yes, let's do it, because I was a little scared. He was like, we're going to get DNA Lounge, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to do all this crazy stuff. I was like, whoa,
yeah, you're
slow
like, whoa,
down.
Whoa, whoa.
Like, holy, you know, like, we just had a bunch of people into a bar and had fun. You know, you're talking about putting up a lot of money to rent a venue, and who knows, are we going to get it back, and are people going to pay to play?
Yeah, you were probably thinking more along the lines of the old PGC karaoke nights after E3, right?
Yeah, exactly, with like a few more people hanging around. No, that's precisely what it was. And he was like, no, if we you know, put this effort in, we can get the money. And so he really had the vision. I was just like, okay, I believe in you. And then more recently, a couple of months ago, Joe Markert, who runs a company called Game Helper, was really interested in helping out, and I kind of asked him what he thought, and he had all these ideas, and I was like, okay, well, you should just come on. And so now we're actually a registered nonprofit organization in the state of California.
Cool.
So everything, and I'm the president of Rockin' Out or whatever, but so now I'm the president of a company. And my role, Seg is the event planner. Joe is very much the brains behind the marketing of the whole thing, and my role is essentially media relations. And so mm-hmm. what I've really been doing is approaching, because I have all the contacts at video game companies, is approaching them and saying, hey, this is what we're doing. Can you help out? And just sort of arranging all of that level of stuff. It's a pretty decent division of powers that we've got going on, considering that all three of us come from different spheres in the video game industry. I wrote practically everything on the website.
Mm-hmm. So how has the response been from the different game companies?
The response from the game companies has largely been, gee, we wish we'd heard about this earlier. And the thing is that we've only really cranked up the getting people aware about this stuff over the last couple of months. And so a lot of game companies have, you know, joined up and pledged to donate. As far as big sponsors of the event, Astro Gaming is donating some money towards the cost of the event, and they're going to have some prizes in the raffle. Harmonix is obviously a really big sponsor. They're bringing some of their people out here. Innis, the wonderful people at Innis, have decided to be a gold sponsor and help us out with some money. And actually, we just found out that and it's an Austin-based company called Heatwave Technologies. I hope I just said that right. It's called Heatwave Technologies, yeah. Who are doing some interesting stuff in music games and have some hookups with Harmonix and stuff like that are actually going to be the platinum sponsors of this event. And they've really helped out quite a bit with covering the event costs. And that's why I've promised to say their name a minimum of three times in any nice Heatwave podcast that I do. Heatwave.
So in the future, you've talked a little bit about the future of the event, but is there anything else more concrete, or are you just kind of going to see how this year goes in terms of size of venue and stuff like that before making any changes?
I feel like we've, and I don't know, you know, maybe next year we'll do it in the Oakland Coliseum to a crowd of 40,000 people, but I'm not quite sure that's going to happen. I feel like we've probably got an event size that's good. DNA Lounge has a maximum of 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Next year, we're definitely going to be able to do some more things because we're now an officially recognized nonprofit organization, which gives us a little more freedom in terms of how we can fundraise.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we were kind of restricted by the fact that we weren't, and we only kind of just got all that taken care of because it's an involved process getting that set up. So, I mean, next year, the future looks very bright for Umlaut as far as the passion of the people who are doing it and the fact that I am just amazed at, when you mention really Child's Play, the people who come out and want to help you, and the fact that Child's Play has been great too. You know, we're recognized by Child's Play as being we're not part of Child's Play at all, but you know, they recognize us as being an official unofficial Child's Play event. You know,
so you guys are entirely on your own then. You're not handing money over to Child's Play or what exactly are you doing there?
Oh yeah, no, all of the we're getting sponsors to take care of the event costs, such that all of the donations that people make, and we're taking donations at the door, and we're obviously taking donations to play Rock Band and other sorts of things during the event, but every donation that comes from an individual or that purchases a band pass, the goal is to have all of that go directly to Child's Play, and that seems like something that we're very safely able to do.
Very, very cool.
When Seg and I put down the money for DNA Lounge out of our own pockets to reserve the venue, so
that's scary because it's a lot of money to rent a place like that.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I wanted to get you on here to, like, you know, pimp it a little bit, just because I think it's a really good event that I think will be around for years to come. Now, do you think that it'll be that it could maybe expand into other cities?
What we've been talking about, and this is all very much kind of in the works right now, not final. We don't necessarily want to expand the event out to more cities, but we want to help people put on their own,
yeah,
right? So to really kind of open source it rather than run events in different cities, because I'll tell you, running one, hard enough.
Yeah.
And I would like to set up something that says, hey, do you want to run something like this? Well, we'll help you out. We'll let you know what we did. You just sort of give you that advice. Because it's not that tough to do the small scale version, to just get a bar that will let you, you know, take over the bar that night with Rock Band,
mm-hmm,
and set up somebody's Xbox and play Rock Band and have a raffle. So what I'm hoping for is that people will kind of pick up on that and do it on their own.
Yeah. Now, PAX is coming up in Boston. Now, is there going to be anything going on there? Maybe PAX next year in Seattle?
I want to go. I went to college in Boston, actually, and haven't really spent a lot of time there since then. And I definitely do want to go to PAX East. I think we were talking about doing some Retronaut stuff at PAX East, but again, that's very that's all still very much up in the air.
Now, if people want to donate, they can of course do it at the event. But if they can't make it to the event for whatever reason, the website is umlaut.org.
Yep.
And you can donate right there on the website, correct?
You can, yeah. Actually, we've got a Google checkout set up, and Penny Arcade uses PayPal, or Child's Play uses PayPal. So if you don't want to use PayPal and you want to use Google checkout, you can do it through us, and that'll get passed on directly to Child's Play.
Very, very nice. Cool. All right, well, that's pretty much all I have to talk about there. Anything else you want to add, Chris, just to wrap it up?
You know, this is something that, for me, is I really love playing Rock Band on big stages. And, you know, I think we're just sort of harnessing that same kind of desire in other people to, you know, because it doesn't even feel like you're giving to charity when what you get in return is the ability to pretend that you're a rock star for 3 minutes.
Awesome.
Chris, thanks very much for getting involved in something like this, and obviously taking a lot of financial risk and putting in a ton of your time to do it. It's very, very respectable.
You're welcome, Planet Earth. No, it's been a lot of work, and it's been a lot of fun, and I think that everybody should consider what they can do. This has been very, very kind of fulfilling for me. You know what I mean? Like it's really kind of re-energized me to be doing this.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll break there, and we will come back with a quick discussion on retro game collecting. All right, we're back, and we're going to talk about retro game collecting, something that is near and dear definitely to everybody's hearts, especially Chris and myself.
What a coincidence.
And this is actually, I have to admit, this was actually inspired by something that Chris posted on his Game Life blog on Wired.com a little while ago. He can perhaps tell the story of how his parents grabbed him a Vectrex.
Yeah, well, not much to tell. My parents
went. Wait, what is a Vectrex?
What is it? Oh, that's very important. Yes.
Let's
back up. The Vectrex was on sale for like a year and a half back in the early 80s. It was developed by a company called GCE, but it was marketed in the end by Milton Bradley. It was a video game system with a built-in vector graphics monitor.
Perfect.
So very much like Asteroids or Tempest or games like that, where the graphics were drawn not with pixels, but with a gun that actually drew lines with XY coordinates, which gave you these really, really beautiful, crisp graphics, because you had, instead of these big, chunky pixels, really, really fine lines. The monitor was only black and white, as were many of the vector games in the arcade. Not all, but many. And imagine, it was sort of like the Virtual Boy of that era. Insofar as it came out, it was kind of cool and interesting. And then it just sort of, I mean, it came out in 1982, I think. You know, just in time for the whole industry to go over a cliff. And they cleared them all out at Toys R Us for like $15 each, and they disappeared. That was kind of how it was, like the Virtual Boy. It was on shelves 1 minute, like the next minute it was $20, and the next minute you never heard from it again.
Well, it was and the thing is, it was entirely self-contained, right?
Yes. Yeah, so it had the monitor, and all you did was plug it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, you know, if you wanted to take it on vacation with you, if you're going away for a week, you could put it in your hotel or your cabin or wherever the hell you were.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was entirely self-contained, so it didn't take up the TV. It had all these really interesting, yeah, it's like, you know, hey, kids, don't want to bother your parents and use the family TV, use the Vectrex or whatever. So, you know, but I mean, all of that was absolutely for naught. And the reason why it's so collectible, A, there aren't very many of them because it was not very popular. B, every time a monitor breaks, well, that's the end of the Vectrex. It is just a very clever piece of hardware, very unique. You know, nothing like it.
Now, for me, it's kind of a holy grail, because you have to understand, at this time I was growing
36.
Up, I was a small child in Canada, just a wee babe, and I think that this thing appeared
skipping merrily among the moose.
This thing appeared, I think, in the Sears catalog. For one Christmas, because back then it was like, you know, you would get the Sears catalog and you would just pour through it, and I would look at the G.I. Joe and the Transformers toys and the video games, and this thing was in there for one Christmas, and I never saw it again, and that was it. I never actually, I don't think I've ever actually seen it in a store, on a store shelf. I've never seen it. So this was kind of like one of those things where I thought it was the coolest thing at the time. I'm like, oh man, asteroids, it's amazing. So I've been looking for one ever since. And so when I saw Chris on there basically bragging, throwing it in my face, if you will, unknowingly, I had to get his thoughts on retro game collecting. So here we are.
Well, I think that illustrates one of the most important things about retro game collecting. If you're trying to find old retro games, mm-hmm. don't be embarrassed about it, and let every person you know that you are into old video games, because that is how you find people who say, "Oh, I've got this up in my attic. You can just take it." or in my case, you know, since my parents are very well aware of the fact that I like this stuff, they're constantly on the lookout for it. And in this case, they saw this Vectrex in a thrift store and gave me a call in the middle of the workday and asked me if this was something that I wanted.
And you're like, yeah.
And yes. Well, actually, no, because originally what they said was, so first of all, you also have to know, a couple of years ago, my dad found a Vectrex like on the side of the road. And the monitor was broken. What it apparently was there's a logic chip in there that actually, you know, sends the signals out to the gun to draw the lines on the monitor, and that was fried. Or apparently that's a very common problem with these things. So you turn it on and you just see one single dot in the middle of the monitor because the gun's not moving. So that sucked. And then they got another one at a thrift store for a few dollars, and that was broken too, but it was broken in a different way. Like, the joystick port was busted. So I think at one point, my brother and dad, who still both live in Connecticut, and that's where all these are, were like, oh, let's, you know, we can combine the two and make one Franken-Vectrex that actually works. And I knew that was never actually going to happen. Like, because I wasn't going to push them to do it, and they weren't just going to do it, you know, on their own. And I I'd sort of given up on the idea. So they called me and they said, there's a Vectrex. And I'm like, okay, great. And they said, well, hold on, because it's $95. And I was like, oh, well, you know, screw that. Like, a Vectrex, a working Vectrex is probably worth about $100. But if I want a working Vectrex for $100, I'll just go onto eBay, you know, through a reputable dealer and buy one. You know, I'm not going to get one from a thrift store that got it in a donation bin and doesn't know if it works or what.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, are there any games? And that's one of the really important things, is that the consoles generally aren't really worth that much, but certain games can be worth quite a bit. Duh. So they start reading off a list of games, and the first few games that they get to, meanwhile, I'm sitting at my computer at work, and I've got a Vectrex rarity list open, you know, and I'm just sort of I'm just checking,
just,
you know,
handy.
As they say, well, no, you know, I just sort of ran over and I opened the thing up, and they start reading off games that are listed as with a rarity value of like 8 out of 10, you know, 7 out of 10. And then I start clicking on those individual games, and it's like the cartridge alone, let alone the box and the instruction manuals and everything, are worth for some of these games $50 to $60.
Wow.
And as soon as they read off two of those, I was like, and these games have boxes? They're like, oh yeah, they have boxes, instructions, everything. I'm like, okay, yeah, time, buy it.
Yeah,
no, we don't
up.
Need to have this phone conversation anymore. Just buy it. And as it turns out, it had a light pen accessory, because what this thing let you do is you could use the light pen and draw on the screen, and it would actually, you know, draw vector lines based on what you were drawing.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so it had great. That. It had I can't wait to try it out. Actually, when I go home for Christmas, I'm gonna get to actually play this thing. It had a bunch of games that were all worth a bunch of money. The thing was probably worth, I mean, you know, conservative estimate, $500, maybe $600 for everything. And so that was a score, right? I mean, that was like a huge, awesome buy. The sort that you don't really usually find that much in wandering into thrift stores these days. Mostly because a lot of the stuff is either in the hands of collectors or on eBay at this point.
Now, they're actual cartridges with overlays for the different games, right? That's
they
how the Vectrex worked.
Yeah, they had overlays, I think, for every game had a monitor overlay, because, of course, it was a black and white monitor, and so the overlay gave you a sort of a colored play field.
So I have kind of a newbie question regarding Vectrex, because when you talk about vector graphics and arcade games, the number one game that comes to my mind is Star Wars.
Oh.
And I was just curious if they ever released a version of that on the Vectrex, because that would be the only home system that could ever play it the original way.
I want to say that they did. There's definitely, either a Star Wars or a Star Trek game. Maybe Star Trek.
Yeah.
Man, I mean, if the Vetrex had the Star Wars arcade game in 82, that seems like such a coup to me, on the order of maybe, you know, ColecoVision getting Donkey Kong. Because in 82, the Star Wars video game, I mean, that would have been huge.
So no Star Wars game. Did have Star Trek the motion picture.
Oh, good.
Star Wars.
Oh, that sounds...
That's the first motion picture, by the way.
The motionless picture.
It's not even Wrath of Khan. I mean, that just tells you...
I bet you it was very similar to... I haven't played the game. I'm sure it was very similar to the Star Wars arcade game.
Yeah.
There wasn't that much you could really do with a Vectrex. But yeah, that was pretty awesome. And I mean, you know, out in here in San Francisco, and I post these occasionally on Wired as well, all the thrift store stuff that I find. Mm-hmm. I'm actually working on one now. I went into a Goodwill, and I can't even imagine how this would happen, but a copy of Castlevania Symphony of the Night for the Saturn... And the soundtrack, the original soundtrack to Symphony of the Night, the Japanese releases of both these things, just sitting in a thrift store in San Francisco. There's no other Saturn games, no other video game soundtracks, just these two just sitting there. Like somebody just decided they just were just sick of Symphony of the Night and just threw them
away. Somebody must have, see, that's the kind of thing where somebody must have you know, broken into somebody's apartment and stolen them.
And then
no idea
and
what
then
these
donated
are.
Them to a wait and then donated them to a Goodwill.
Someone like me. What?
That sounds like the stupidest thief ever. Like I'm going mm-hmm. to okay. I'm going to break into people's houses. All right. I'm going to steal their valuable stuff. Okay. Then I'm going to give it to charity.
They're very giving thieves.
Maybe it was maybe someone inherited it or who knows, but they found it or stole it or whatever. But then they tried to take it to GameStop and they're like,
yeah.
They just got laughed at.
I'm just saying that there is a certain amount of ignorance involved in that transaction, regardless of
right,
where it
right,
came
right.
from.
Yeah, oh, no, most definitely, yeah. But, I mean, at the same time, I wouldn't think that the Saturn version of Symphony of the Night would really grab very much money on eBay or anything like that either. But, I mean, it's a pretty terrible version. I don't know how obscure it is, but...
But it does. I mean, I certainly know in Japan, if you want to go buy that in a store, it's between, like, $50 and $60.
Doesn't matter how good it is, just how hard it is to find.
Mm-hmm. With no transparencies.
You know, it matters. Both matter. I mean, obviously, if something is really super rare, it doesn't matter what the content of the game is. It's going to be very expensive. But a lot of expensive games, I mean, the whether or not the game is good definitely factors into that. If it's rare, it's worth money. If it's really good and rare, the price becomes... Like, for example, Radiant Silver Gun, right? From the Saturn.
Mythical title, yeah.
It's not that rare of a game. Like, you can find it in any video game store in Japan. You can find tons of copies on eBay all the time. It was a treasure shooter on a hardcore system. Like, it's not rare. It's uncommon, and it's awesome, and there's no other version of it.
Right.
That's why it's... I mean, all those things contribute to it being really expensive. You know, Sin and Punishment for a while, that was not rare, but it was good, and you couldn't play it anywhere else. And the price of the N64 version in Japan crept up and up and up.
Yeah, I've got that version, too.
Yeah, I think I did have it. I think I might have sold it on eBay for actually quite a bit of money when I got rid of my N64.
I bought it new. I was living there when the N64 was finishing out its life, and so I just bought it in a store.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone down in price now, though.
Well, yeah,
the
I'm sure.
Availability of stuff like that on emulation destroys the price.
Yeah, that must be having a really, really big... I mean, I'm sure you know more about that than I would, but in terms of bringing down the prices, that must be scaring a lot of people that collect these things. Or maybe not. I mean, perhaps the physical version is probably always preferred. I mean,
yeah. I mean, if you're collecting as a speculator, which I absolutely am not. But if you're doing, I like knowing what things are worth. You know, I like getting. I mean, that's really for me. It's like I got a good deal. You know,
yeah.
I mean, for me to spend what something is worth and get that thing is just sort of like, oh, okay. But to find something that I wouldn't spend, you know, full price on for a couple of dollars in a thrift store. That's the sort of the thrill of the, you know, of hunting for things like that and finding them.
Mm-hmm.
But collecting as a speculator, you really have to know your shit. Like, you really need to look and say, what is the possibility of this thing getting re-released?
Mm-hmm.
What is the possibility of somebody emulating it at a later date? And if the possibility of that is zero, then you know you've got something that's going to hold its value. Like, there's a bunch of Atari 2600 games out there right now that no one in their right mind is ever going to re-release, because they don't know who owns the rights to them. Like, it's these little fly-by-night companies that shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So in those cases, you know that you know the, that these games are never going to appear on virtual console or stuff that's with licensed characters, which rarely also make a return. But I mean, with stuff like Sin and Punishment, like that was inevitable that somebody was going to release that at some point. Rez, you know, people there. I remember people were so mad because they bought like 10 sealed copies of Rez, and then they were all, you know, those, they were all worth a lot of money each, and then, you know, then they reprinted Rez, and then Rez HD came out, and the value of PlayStation 2 Rez, you know, has since gone down quite a bit.
Now, in terms of PS2 games, probably one of the games that's still high is Ico, or Ico, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's because that has not come out again.
It's been on my Gamefly queue for about a year.
Because they can't find a copy.
Just leave it up there, and then when it comes in, keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. That's
probably
it's
going up in Japan as well. When I was there, I was really surprised to see, like, Ico, first edition, you know, we'll pay you 4,000 yen, about $40 for it. That's what they'll pay someone to, you know, sell it back to the store.
Yeah.
So that's really surprising, and that's, you know, it's, people want the original edition, not the best edition with the yellow stripe on it or whatever.
So, aside from the Vetrex, Chris, I'm kind of curious, what are your most prized possessions in terms of game collections?
I mean, you know, I have a lot of, like, really cool... I feel like we've even talked about this before, but, I mean, back in Connecticut is all the Nintendo stuff that I brought back from Japan. So I've got most of the early pre-Famicom dedicated systems that Nintendo made, like the Pong systems and you know, a racing game, you know, just, you know, plug-and-play TV games, essentially, from the 70s.
And the Game & Watch stuff was back then, too.
The Game & Watch stuff, yeah. So I've got a couple of Game & Watches, but it's nothing compared to my Nintendo, like, home stuff collection. I have an Ella Conga, which is one of Nintendo's the toys they made before they even made video games. It was like, it was apparently designed by Gunpei Yokoi. It's an electronic conga drum, and you hit buttons on the top of this thing to generate beats. I got it from an old toy store in Kyoto. as far as lots and lots of that stuff, you know, that I kind of brought back from Japan, and I only, you know, I saw it once, you know, and I just bought it, and I've never seen another one. But as far as, like, thrifting stuff here, like, probably the best thrifting day that I ever had was, it's a Salvation Army store that was in downtown San Francisco and is now closed. And I walked in, and I'm looking at the bookshelves, and there's a black box NES copy of Donkey Kong. And I'm like, oh, nice. You know, hey, I'm glad I came in here. And it's, like, complete, you know. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I start looking around, and I look on the next shelf over, and the entire next shelf over is just full of black box NES games.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, damn. And I start, like, grabbing everything off. They were $2 each, you know. Like, I'm just grabbing all of them off the shelf, and I just, you know, just everything. There were about, I would say, 15 black box NES games or so, and then just as a kicker, Final Fight 3 complete for the Super Nintendo.
That's awesome.
For $2 each, and I get all the damn things home, and I realize that these aren't just black box NES games. As near as I can figure, these are launch titles, possibly from when Nintendo did the first test marketing of the NES in late 85, that first Christmas season. Obviously, no way of verifying this, but we know, A, that they sold them in New York City, and they sold them in FAO Schwartz stores all around the U.S., all the FAO Schwartz retail stores. There used to be one in downtown San Francisco, and these games have FAO Schwartz price stickers on the box. Also, apparently these games were never sealed, or were never shrink-wrapped, because what they've all got, and I've never, ever seen this before, each one of these games has, on the front flap of the box, a round black sticker with the Nintendo logo on it. And it's like those stickers that used to be on Blockbuster video cartridges, that if you pull it off, it says void. but it says Nintendo, and that's the only thing, apparently, that sealed these boxes shut. Like, they were just unshrink-wrapped, and they had a little sticker on them. And also, you know how certain early NES games, they just took a Famicom board, and they put it into a Famicom to NES converter, and they shoved all that into a cartridge?
Mm-hmm.
So, there were three of those in this set. Three of these games had that setup in there. And so all those things combined makes me think very much like I just stumbled onto basically a launch day NES collection, because all these things were very, very were different, or sort of indicated to me that that was the case. I'll never really know, but that was super awesome. Like, oh man.
So have you been able to appraise them and find out what they're worth? Somebody must know what they're worth.
You know, here's the thing. I would be able to tell you what they're worth, and they're worth whatever a buyer will pay for them, and you need to get two people competing over these things, and then we'll see how much, you know, somebody's willing to go up to. The thing is, nobody's really talked about these things before. You know, I've never seen any conversations about, you know, oh, do I have NES launch titles or whatever, and I've never seen any indication that people might be willing to pay more for these than they would just normal copies of the NES black box games, which have been going up in value for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think these are going to be worth more later as more information comes out, or if more people decide that they want to pay for these.
Yeah.
But generally right now, collectible video game prices are depressed because there's a lot of supply out there. You know, you can log on to eBay and find practically any classic game that of your heart's desire, and you can buy it. And also, it's a recession, and in a recession, you know, people still spend money on frivolous entertainment, but they're going to spend money on their first, second, and third choices, and then their fourth, fifth, and sixth choices, the things that are the most frivolous and have absolutely no utility whatsoever, are going to drop out. And of course, that's, you know, collectible old video games.
Yep.
And so we're at a point right now where it is 100% a buyer's market. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if people are interested in building up a collection, this is the time to do it, because things hit eBay and they sell for very, very little. And I think that is going to come back up. What's interesting, what's really, really interesting, is that the high end is going higher and the low end is going lower. So recently, just this year, some of the highest prices ever paid for collectible video games were paid. The Nintendo World Championships gold cartridge, which was given out as a prize to the kids who played in that Nintendo tournament from the 80s,
mm-hmm.
That just sold for, I think it was $17,500, and that's the most that's ever been paid for one of those. And somebody just sold a NES Campus Challenge cartridge, which is similar but was never actually publicly distributed, and there might be only one of them left, for I think over $20,000. And maybe something has outpaced them, but some of the highest prices ever paid for a single video game. So in that sense, it's going a lot higher. But in another sense, if you're just buying sort of uncommon stuff and building out a collection, this is the time to do it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, now that games are so easy to get on the Wii, older games, I mean, the thing is, the stuff that's really rare becomes even rarer and therefore worth more.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, we're starting to find out what's rare, what's actually seriously rare in a digital world.
Yeah.
Right? When things can be copied, what doesn't get copied? And of course, Nintendo's not going to release the Nintendo World Championships cartridge is still rare. It doesn't matter if Nintendo releases that to the Virtual Console, because it's not the content that people are after.
It's the actual physical cartridge.
But in cases where people are, in fact, after the content, that does, as we discussed, drive down the price. Because, you know, again, it's not so much owning the Sin and Punishment cartridge, it's getting to play Sin and Punishment.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, personally, I'm not much of a game collector, which is funny, because I probably own hundreds of video games if you really, you know, if I really compiled it all together. A lot of them are in the attic. But, I mean, I have almost 100 games. Well, I have probably 60, 75 games on Virtual Console. So for me, all that really matters is that I can play it.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is, most of those I don't actually play. Like, I like having the access to play them if I ever feel like it. But a lot of Virtual Console games I download once and I play it, and I'm like, oh yeah, still good. I never go back to it.
That's right.
Kind of a waste of money. But, well, and I used to write a lot of recommendations for the site, which kind of necessitated downloading a lot of games.
Yeah.
So I've slowed down a lot as Virtual Console releases have slowed down as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I feel like my tastes are not nearly as exotic as you two, because I'm a little younger than John. I think Chris and I are about the same age. But if I could own any retro game system and a couple of games for it, it'd probably be the Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
So I could play Radiant Silvergun and Panzer Dragoon Saga.
Oh.
And I could have that set, you know, for $200-$300. It's just I'm not $300 interested in it. You know, that's the problem.
Also, people who suggest that I have all of the thrifting luck in San Francisco should know that the store closest to me, the one that I hit all the time, apparently somebody else went there and found a copy of Panzer Dragoon Saga for $7.
What a burn.
And fuck that guy. Yeah.
Well, if I could find that, I'd build a Saturn if I could find a copy of that game for $7.
Out of twigs.
Yeah.
That's, again, I mean, in most cases, the rarest game for a console will be worth an order of magnitude what the console is worth. Saturns are worthless. Mm-hmm. Saturn games, though.
Yeah. I mean, the ones that I'm looking for, I mean, like right now, back at my parents' place, I do have an Atari 2600, one of the newer ones, though. And one of my big regrets in my gaming career, as I like to call it, that has never made me any money whatsoever.
It's cost you money.
Exactly. One of the things that I regret the most was selling the wood grain Atari 2600 that I used to have, which was in perfect shape, pretty much pristine, and I sold that thing, and I think I probably used the money from that and put it towards like a Sega Master System or something terrible.
Oh, nice.
Something
choice.
Terrible like that. One of my biggest embarrassments.
Those are getting more and more expensive now too. Just buying an Atari 2600 system, you're gonna if somebody's selling a 2600 in actual good working condition with a couple of games on eBay, mm-hmm. used to be you couldn't get very much for those, and now they regularly end above $100.
Even the newer ones?
Yeah, pretty much. Just that original working Atari. I think a lot of people want the old wood grain system, but you know, in a pinch, they'll deal with the newer one, which isn't that much newer.
Yeah, because this one was actually the one I got was actually a pretty good score. Because I think I bought it for $25 and it probably had about 20 different games with it. It just came in a box. Uh-huh. And somebody was just like, $25, take it. I'm like, okay.
So all right.
Perfectly working 2600 with about 20 to 25 games.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot more discriminating, mostly because I have a bunch of most of the common games and everything like that.
Yeah.
So at this point, like, it's got to have something actually rare in it before I'll buy it. Now, you know, I did just buy a TurboGrafx with a bunch of games. Mm. And so this brings me up to, I think, seven TurboGrafx's. Well, actually, let me count on. So I've got the... At one point, I actually went through in Connecticut and found that just over the years I had collected, it was like seven or eight.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally, I had to like get Turbo. I think there's more TurboGrafx's now than there were then. Like those things just,
they're multiplying
all the time.
Well, it's like, it's such a great console because there was like about four different, you know, versions of it released in the US, about four or five of them released in Japan. I mean, you could have like a whole soccer team of just, you know, PC Engine / TurboGrafx 16 consoles sitting in your basement.
Which
yeah,
John
we're counting
does.
My super gra- yeah.
It's so funny, Chris, that you own so many TurboGrafx. I don't think I've ever actually touched one.
My parents just kept coming home with them.
I was a little bit sheltered as a child. I primarily played Nintendo games, so I rarely saw anything. And TurboGrafx was like something I'd heard of, but
I didn't know anyone who had it. I say that because, I mean, as a kid, I remember playing it at Toys R Us, and like that's it. Like I don't remember playing a TurboGrafx contemporaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I apparently just shit TurboGrafx's in my sleep to judge by
the world's foremost owner of TurboGrafx.
You're the kingpin.
I'm heading into double digits. Somebody just offered me one. Somebody's just like, hey, I got a TurboGrafx. I'm like, no!
You just attract them.
No, I want a TurboGrafx.
Yeah.
Hey, dirty Santa gifts, you know?
Actually, I'm going to give one away at Umlaut.
Oh, cool.
Because nice. I have two now. Well, if it works.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't work, I'll just throw it out.
Yep, now, I may still have my TurboGrafx 16 back at my parents' place. It's sitting in a closet. Now, I do have, let's see, I think I have my Super NES and NES both in the box. Like, I have both those guys and the TurboGrafx 16 in the box. So, I used to be a hoarder. I'm still a hoarder, but not as much, but...
Yeah, it's bad, because when I went into my storage closet after I heard this was going to be our topic, and I went through there, and I just sort of rifled through what I've got. I've got, like, the old big monster in television that's, like, the size of a table.
No.
That's about 4.5 years older than I am. And I've got all these really terrible-sounding games that I just look at them, I'm like, this sounds awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go look them up, and they're, like, rare. And I'm like, well, that's wonderful.
Like Frantic Freddy and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's stuff like that. It's just
okay, so, James, I think you'll especially appreciate this, the title of this game. I remember once my parents went on a vacation, left me, my sister and I at the house. We had, I don't know, a grandmother or somebody taking care of us while they were gone. They came back with, you know, their suntans and all their crazy stories of everything that happened, and they had brought us gifts.
Oh, no.
And my gift was a Sega Genesis game called Awesome Possum Kicks Dr. Machino's Butt.
I just awesome. Found one of those. I just found one of those games.
I still have what? It somewhere. I have. It sounds like the kind of thing that's probably worth money just because it's so bizarre.
No. it's worth like $10 if it's complete, you know. And
that's more than I would expect, actually.
It's worth only your shattered dreams, Johnny.
I just found one with the KB sticker still on it.
It's actually not that bad of a game. I mean, I remember playing it.
I want to play it. I'm actually trying to play the games that I find these days, because I'll come home with like 10 games, you know, after like a day of just, you know, going all around, and then I won't play them, you know, and so it's sort of worthless. So I'm actually trying to sit myself down and play them.
Yeah, you did actually play the game, though, that you had. Didn't you have, like, a poll at the, was it the Classic Gaming Expo or PAX, where you had a poll and people told you which terrible game to buy and play?
Yes. Yeah, so last year at Penny Arcade Expo, I wanted to buy a TurboGrafx game. They had Shina Warrior and they had...
Oh, no.
What was the other one? Oh, no, yeah. And, what the hell? Vigilante. And so I was like, I want to buy one of these. I want to buy either Shina Warrior or Vigilante. And I just put up a post and I said, tell me which one to buy.
Terrible games.
And people, I know, both
awful. One-dimensional as hell.
Absolutely.
It's like a cardboard stand-up of a game on both of those games.
Hey, guys, I'm looking for a terrible game. Pick one.
Yeah. So basically, they voted Shina Warrior, and I bought Shina Warrior, and then recently I had a Turbo Express that I had found, and I played it on that, and I wrote a little bit about it. So, so god awful. And so this year I went back to to a different dealer who was there, and I wanted to do it again, and I really wanted to do it right this time. So I talked to him, we went through all the stuff that he had, and we decided on either Gilligan's Island for the NES or Rocky and Bullwinkle for the NES.
Oh god, no. I know all about that game. Oh,
which
God.
One? Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Is it awful?
It's bad.
I got Gilligan's Island.
Oh, you
people voted for that.
I think you were spared.
I think Gilligan's Island is a lot funnier.
Gilligan's Island. I ended up writing what I thought was a pretty good piece about Gilligan's Island, but it was a horrible, horrible, horrible game. I couldn't even believe how fucking bad it was. And
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say Rocky and Bullwinkle would have elicited the same response.
Well, I bet it would have.
That's one of the first games as a child I remember going, this is terrible.
Who made that game? Like who?
I don't know. I just remember playing it as a child going, oh my god.
Yeah, and as a child, you know, children tend to be, a lot of times, are more forgiving of things like that. So when I remember playing Superman for the NES and thinking, what the fuck's going on? Like, it makes no sense. It's actually better than the N64 game, but it's still absolutely atrocious. Mm-hmm. And you got to think, like, 6 years old, and I'm like, what is this?
This is
awful. It's got to be bad. Yeah. I mean, I would love to go back and play it now and just relive that feeling.
All right, so what's number one on your list now to go after, Chris? I mean, what is your fantasy kind of find?
Wow.
Because, I mean, I'm still looking for the Vectrex, but also I'm looking also for, like, I still have an old Commodore 64, but I want to find a Commodore Amiga.
I mean, you know what I'd love to stumble upon? And, I mean, you know, there's a huge list of games, right, that I'd love to stumble upon, but what would be really amazing for me is if I just sort of randomly found a copy of Stadium Events for the NES and a Family Fun Fitness Pad. I think that would be pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Because as you may or may not know, the Power Pad was originally released in Japan by Bandai. It was called the Family Fun Fitness, or excuse me, it was called Family Trainer in Japan. And then they released it in the US as the Family Fun Fitness Pad and released the first game, Stadium Events. And Nintendo was like, whoa, actually, this is awesome. So how about we'll just give you a shitload of money and we'll put this game in the box and we'll call it World Class Track Meet and we'll call this thing the Power Pad. And Bandai was like, thank you. and I think they all profited quite a bit from that little arrangement. But there are copies of stadium events out there, and there are Family Fun Fitness pads that were designed, you know, for the U.S. So that Bandai actually released.
Do they look appreciably different from the power pad, from the power set?
They do. It's all it's very brightly colored, much like the Japanese version. So lots of bright primary colors. They don't look futuristic.
Good.
It's not all gray.
Yeah, see, those power pad kind of games, they seem to always be really rare several years after their release. Like, I was reading that the DDR Mario mix is actually quite rare now. And it's going
the Japanese
up in price.
Version and the pad. It's actually one of my favorite DDRs.
I had mine stacked up by my window, so now my copy is intact but sun faded on one side, which kind of sucks.
No, just killing that value, man.
You got to store your shit well, kids.
Yeah, that's
now
right.
It's all in the closet.
Pro tip from Chris Kohler, right there.
Yep, store things properly. I've had mice eat instruction manuals, so put it all into plastic bins that mice can't chew through when you put it in your closet.
Yeah. Yeah, my only story like that is I had a buddy spill beer on my copy of Symphony of the Night for PS1, which was one of my most prized.
Yeah.
That's
my most
fairly
prized game.
Easy to replace though, John.
It's fairly easy to replace, but it was
there.
In such good shape though. It was in like perfect shape. That's the whole thing, and it's kind of hard to find those unless they're sealed and completely overpriced. But man, and it was one of those things where I didn't find out that he had spilled beer on it until about 6 months afterwards. So it was a lost cause.
Why does it smell like beer?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I went to move the, like, it was just sitting there on a shelf, and I guess he had spilled beer above it, and it had just fallen. The beer
on
like,
the shelf.
Yeah. The beer had dripped down onto it. And so the thing is, I was moving, I had all the games lined up, and I went to move them, and they all moved as one because they were all stuck together. I'm like, no, you son of a bitch.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, it sucked.
John lost a friend that day, and his friend lost a life.
It's another dead soldier. Well, that's it, man. That's it. That's all I got.
So, Chris, before you go, I mean, you should pimp your stuff. Of course, you talked all about Umlaut, but how about these fine literature books that you have?
Literature books?
If you or someone you know is a publisher of books and would like me to write another book, all you need to do is just address any communications to me at chris@umlaut.org. Will actually work.
Yeah, I think we can guarantee there will be a chapter about the incredible skyrocketing value and desirability of black box NES launch titles, right?
Yeah. Also, the skyrocketing value of Power Up, my first book, which they printed 15 copies of and then sent them all to Omaha. So if you actually have one,
I have
good
one
for you.
I do have one, actually.
All right.
And I have a quote on the back of that.
You're
book,
in a small
actually.
Club. You are. You do. Yes, that's right. Yes. Thank you for that.
That is a very fine book, and I actually do highly recommend it. I mean, I don't read a lot of video game books, but I have
you
also
don't read,
read
a lot of words actually.
Oh,
in general.
Okay.
To be fair,
I read Anna Karenina this year. So
John's getting all defensive now.
Yes.
So I mean, so Johnny, now that you're finished reading the title Anna Karenina, which is very difficult, are you gonna actually crack the book or what?
Yes, but I would say that I've read Game Over by David Sheff, and I think Power Up is just as good. It's not nearly as famous, but it's just as good, and I think they're both really essential reading, especially for Nintendo fans, because they cover some of the same ground. There's some overlap, but they're told in a very different way, and they kind of have different perspectives on how that stuff worked. So, yeah, I really do highly recommend it.
Thank you. I've never read it, but I hear it's good.
The funny thing is, I had not actually read it when I gave you that quote that's on the back. I'd read, like, the first two chapters.
Oh, no one had. Yeah, it wasn't done yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, that's how it works, all right?
And also, I still need to get my copy autographed. I keep forgetting it to bring it to E3. Maybe at PAX East, if we end up going to that.
Mm-hmm. If you're in San Francisco and you come to our trivia night, then you can just bring it and we'll kill two birds with one stone.
Yep, will do.
All right.
Well, that's it, man. Thank you, Chris, for being on the show.
Thank you for letting me talk about all the various aspects of my life as if they were interesting.
Well, they're interesting to me, man.
It's good practice for, you know, when I become famous and everybody's asking me all these questions. Like, what? Where do you get your video games? Well, let me tell you.
All right. That's going to be it for this segment. Johnny, do you want to take us out?
Yeah, actually, that's going to be it for the whole show. So thanks very much to Chris for being on, as John said. And we're going to say goodbye now for this week, and we'll see you next time.
Later.
Goodbye. I don't really think that the kind of like the Pokemon design really lends itself to an MMO.
See,
because
I disagree though, because I mean, if
maybe
there's
if,
a game world,
if you kept the conflict confined to arenas, I could see something like that.
But that's boring. I mean, it should be like Pink Slips, you know, like you beat the other guy, you take one of his Pokemon.
No, that would be too much.
It would be awesome.
I want Pokemon Gank Fest. I'll be honest. I want to roll around with a crew and just gank people's Pokemon.
This game is called Give Me Your Lunch Money and Your Pokemon.
Hey man, you're already famous in our eyes, Chris.
That's scary.
To me, you'll always be a celebrity.
After you kill me in my sleep and eat my brain.
Don't worry, man. I'll just read your mail for a couple of years. It's not a big deal.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, that's cool.
Hopefully our awesome sketches that we've had of John become public, because that's a lot funnier with the crazy eyes Zach drew him with.
They will never become public, not if I can help it. Even though they might get leaked. They might get leaked in like a torrent or something.
They might get leaked in like 30 seconds when we get off this podcast.